Content warning. This episode contains references to violence, suicide, and murder. Please call or visit the hotlines included in the description if you need help.
I murder!
Hi everyone! Welcome to the season 2 premiere of I Murder, the podcast where Gen Z talks murder! I'm your host Jocelyn, and I have a very special surprise for you all. This season, we have a new co-host joining us for our true crime adventures. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey!
Hi!
What's up?
What's up, y'all? No, I'm like, I'm so excited. So this is Yuneska.
Oh yeah, hi, it's Yuneska.
This is Yuneska Colomer. She is my lifelong best friend.
Yeah,
we grew up together. Yuneska and I started getting into true crime like a few years ago, like 2 years ago maybe. So Yuneska and I would like talk about true crime all the time, and we love all these true crime YouTubers, and we like literally watch all of the same people. And I just thought, hey, like for season 2, wouldn't it be more interesting if I brought someone in who was just as interested in true crime as I am? And so here we are. I'm like so excited. Like, I think this season is gonna be great.
Because I'm here.
Yeah, obviously, because you're here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So first, I want to thank all of you guys, all the listeners, for the patience that you guys have had while we prepared this season.
It's Jocelyn's fault.
Yeah, it is. It is my fault, but I think I definitely needed the break a little bit, the little hiatus, just because of college and all of that. But you know what? I think I'm finally getting into the routine of things. I think the season is going to be great, not only because we're going to be covering true crime cases, but in every other episode, we're going to be touching base with the paranormal, telling each other spooky stories we found through deep research. Now, that's something else, Yanni. Like, you and I, we both believe in ghosts. We believe in spirits.
I love supernatural since I think I was born.
No, like, actually, like, we came out of the womb and we were like, oh my god, let's go ghost hunting.
We love.
Only ghosts, but I've always really loved, like, spooky stories.
Spooky
like,
stories and myths them. And, like, oh, all those stuff.
Yeah.
Like, ever since the elementary with Bloody Mary.
Oh, my God. How do you remember that?
Girl.
No, we you're love. So right, though. Like, when we were little, like, we'd tell each other, like, all these spooky stories we'd hear from other kids at school. And, like, it would just give us chills. And we were just so obsessed with it. And yeah, it just makes sense to bring it into this season because I know a lot of you guys are probably interested in that too.
Of course, if you are into true crime, you're into the supernatural. Got me dead.
100%. Got me dead. We're like the Walmart BuzzFeed Unsolved at this point.
Girl, it's a duel. Oh,
it's a duel work. Okay. Who's Shane is Ryan? Okay, got it. Dude, I can't. Anyway. Let's not wait any longer than we already have. Let's get this episode started. So today we're going to tell you about a case that has stuck with me since I first came across it. This case is gripping, unsettling, and most of all, intriguing. In this episode of I Murder, we're going to cover the story of the weepy voiced killer.
You know, I've never actually heard of this story, so it's going to be like the first time.
For real?
I've never actually. I love true crime, but I don't know. For some reason, I've never. Maybe I have, but it just doesn't. I don't remember it. I really don't.
I think maybe once you listen to the recordings, you might be able to. It might become a little familiar to you.
I really doubt. I think I would remember a recording of a man weeping.
Of a weepy voice. Yeah, it's just the voice recording is just him going wee. He's like 911, what's your emergency?
A wee. Got me dead.
Got me dead, dude. Okay, so on December 31st, 1980, Karen Potak, a University of Stevens Point student, was celebrating the new year with a group of friends in the St. Paul, Minnesota area. Karen and her friends had a great time that night, hitting the club and enjoying the city. After the clock struck 1 a.m., the club closed and the group decided to go home. Karen wandered the cold streets of Minnesota alone, hoping to get home safely. She was seen stumbling around with a drink in her hand and without a jacket, despite it having snowed that night. which, can I just say, sounds like an absolute nightmare coming from, like, a Floridian. Because, like, we can't stand 70-degree weather without wearing, like, 7 layers of clothing. Can you imagine?
That's horrible. It's, like, super cold at 70 degrees. We're, like, dying.
We're, like, out here, like, having a...
It's raining. Like, it's snowing.
Yeah, we're, like, having a 110-degree fever with just, like, a 75-degree weather.
We're always wearing sweaters.
Literally, and then there's, like, Karen, and she's, like, just not wearing anything. And she's like, priority. In the snow. She's Elsa. What a queen. Okay, Queen of Arendelle,
we love it.
Love her. Yeah. So Karen entered a seemingly empty alleyway. The only other person there was a man in a car who pulled over and offered to give her a ride home since she was walking alone in the snow. Karen, probably tired and desperate to go home, said yes and got in the car with this complete stranger. Karen was not heard from again for the rest of the night. At around 3 a.m., the Minneapolis Police Department received an eerie phone call.
Yes, please, this is an emergency. Please send a squad to Pierce Butler Road, Muhlenberg Manufacturing Company, machine shop. Please, there's an ambulance, too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
Just hurry. She's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the edge.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you?
Can we just talk about, like, his voice for a second?
It's terrifying, bro. It literally gave me chills. I'm, like, out here by myself, and that's so scary.
No, it was, like, actually, it's so terrifying.
Like, why is he even talking like that?
No, like, my question, like, how does someone's voice go that high? Like, not even Ariana Grande.
Not him being Ariana Grande.
Not him literally being Ariana Grande. No, get him on the voice panel. Like, yeah, he needs to get on there.
Bet. That's scary. It was 100. That really gave me chills. That was really scary. I'm like,
yeah, no, I actually had chills. Like, it sounds straight out of a horror movie.
It literally does. It honestly does.
Minneapolis police rush to the scene and find Karen completely alone and injured on the ground. She was left on a pile of snow and didn't seem to be responding. She was naked, tied up, and her skull was cracked open. You'd expect her to be dead, right? But Karen was still alive. They rushed Karen to the hospital to undergo an emergency surgery, and impressively, she survived. Now the police are focused on figuring out who did this, like who tried to kill this girl. And I think that's a better step than some police departments would have done. From the start, the Minneapolis Police Department didn't treat this case as an assault case. They treated this case as an attempted murder. Which, like, honestly, like, from all the other cases we've heard of, like, ever, the police definitely would not have done that. Like, they would have seen this and yeah, be like, okay, 100%. Assault. Okay, cracked skull open. Like, her skull is completely open. No, it's assault, not murder.
What is he that?
Terrible.
And she's like completely naked for her.
Yeah, like in the snow.
That's
like
crazy. And this man literally called weeping. Stop.
And this man is weeping. We'll get into that later.
Why is
like,
he weeping?
Why is he weeping? Ugh. Like Karen's the one who has her skull open. Like, and I don't know. It's just incredible.
And I just can't imagine her still being alive, also.
Right?
Like, her being alive for all of that's happened.
Through all of that. Because Karen's head injury was so intense, she didn't remember a single thing about her attack. She couldn't remember his appearance or even their interaction the night before. With absolutely no leads, this meant that finding the attacker was going to be very difficult. They had no witness reports either. Karen was found in a manufacturing shop that was completely isolated, so no one would have been around to see her or hear anything. DNA was out of the picture too, given that it's 1981 and DNA testing wasn't as advanced as it is today. Because of the absolute lack of evidence, the case couldn't help but go cold. Until June 3rd, 1981, the Minneapolis police received another short yet odd phone call.
You finally, I just stabbed somebody with an ice pick. I can't stop myself. I keep killing somebody.
Hello? Are you there?
Thoughts? Thoughts?
If I got locked up, I'd kill myself.
Literally, thoughts and prayers. Like, what the hell was that?
This one was more like, not like weepy. It was more like, like, I don't know how to explain it.
Like, Like a,
he had a dry cookie. Like if he got a dry cookie.
Yeah, he sounded like he ate too many saltines and like not like enough water.
It was different. Yeah.
No, I feel it.
I'm gonna be his actor for him. I'm gonna be his voice actor.
No, he should like get him on in like an anime or something. Like, like what a tremendo voice actor, bro.
Yo, but wow, but like that was scary.
No, it's really scary. Like, and you can really hear the desperation in his voice this mm-hmm. time. Like saying that he's killed more people. I can't. Like,
he's the fact that he's actually calling the police though and like talking to them.
Yeah, it's like, crazy, like, the way that he sounds like he's completely split in two, because, like, one side of him is, like, killing these people, and like we saw with Karen, or not killing, but, like, attempting to kill, like, with Karen, the state that she was in was so violent that, like, a normal person couldn't do that. You would have to be, like a raging psychopath to do that. And then you hear him like on the phone call and he's like so remorseful and he's like going crazy. It's mind-boggling that someone it's mind-boggling that someone can like just be split in two like that. What you just heard was the same person from the 911 call begging the police to find them and perhaps stop them from killing people. Now, the police weren't able to connect these phone calls until later on. Keep in mind, a few months had passed and they probably received a big number of cases in between. A few hours after this call, a group of teenagers who were walking down a field by a construction site discovered a girl's body. This girl would be 18-year-old Kimberly Compton. Kimberly had just graduated high school. She was a pretty spontaneous girl and decided that she wanted to spend some time in St. Paul for the next chapter of her life. So she did just that. She packed all of her things and moved to St. Paul. But just hours from having moved to the area, Kimberly was found with wounds to her chest, stomach, and inner thighs. The medical examiner determined that she had been stabbed a total of 61 times with an ice pick, which is complete overkill. An insane amount of anger has to fuel a person to stab someone 61 times. Like, I can't even imagine where someone would get that kind of energy. Like, Red Bull would not be able to power someone up like that.
Girl, oh my god. Not even. He needed to be drinking, like, Red Bull Monster and
Red all Bull, the and he has a Planet Fitness membership to, like, be girl, lifting his arms
he
that
is
much.
Planet Fitness.
He, like, is the CEO of Planet Fitness. This is all alleged for entertainment purposes only. We don't want to get sued by Planet Fitness.
Literally, but no. This man's crazy. And just hours, pobrecita, bro. She just got there.
Yeah, like she just got to St. Paul. She's probably looking forward to her new life, this new chapter of her life. She's fairly young and like so excited, and then this monstrosity happens.
This monster just comes and kills her with an ice pick?
With an ice pick. So not only that, she had also been strangled with a shoelace, but her cause of death was blood loss from the stab wounds that she suffered. So let's follow Kimberly's steps before her gruesome murder. Kimberly had just moved to St. Paul a few hours before and had left her things in a locker while she ran some errands. She felt hungry and decided it was a good time to grab a bite to eat, so she went to Mickey's Diner across the road. The diner only had a few customers. It was a bit empty. Kimberly found an empty booth and sat to eat by herself. One of the only customers in the diner sat a few booths down from Kimberly's. He noticed her come in all alone and thought to strike up a conversation to offer her some company. Kimberly and the man get along pretty well. She tells him all about being new to the city, how she just moved in a few hours ago. The man seemed to be a local and instantly offered to give her a tour around the city so she can get a bit familiarized. She accepted, excited to see more of the city she would now call her home. But a few hours later, the police had received the second phone call we heard earlier. This time, though, the police quickly took the opportunity to trace a phone call to a payphone between the diner, a bar, and a bus station. By the time they arrived at the scene, of course, no one was there. When they investigated the body found by the construction site, the police weren't able to identify the girl right away. They did, however, find a pair of locker keys in her pocket, which led to her belongings back at the locker station. These belongings helped them identify the body as 18-year-old Kimberly Compton. Mind you, at this point, nobody in the area knew Kimberly, so no one was really looking for her. No one would have known her last movements. The investigators' last hope was to track what she did hours before her death through an autopsy. So they sent her body off to be processed by the medical examiner. The ME found that her stomach contents contained beef and fries. This might sound pretty normal to you if you don't live in the St. Paul area, but to the police, who were obviously locals, they knew that the famous special at their local diner was barbecue beef and fries on the day of her murder. So they entered the diner and asked the employees if they recognized Kimberly, which they did. They mentioned how she entered alone, was caught up in a conversation with a strange man, and quickly escorted out with him. The police believed this man was the one who had murdered her. But alas, like the first case, they reached another dead end. There's no concrete evidence of the man, no detailed description of his appearance, absolutely nothing. So the case seemingly goes cold. Until something interesting arises. 2 days after Kimberly's body was discovered, the police received yet another mysterious phone call.
Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to stab her. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every night. I can't believe it. It's just like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'll kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else.
We just listened to the phone call, and I would say this is our cue to rant. I will take the table for a second because yes, I definitely need a rant. What a selfish asshole. Like, he's out here stripping these girls' lives away from them. Like, Karen probably had to undergo an intense recovery for her trauma and injuries. Kimberly will never get to live her independent dream in the city, all because of his quote-unquote uncontrollable actions. And he's whining because he doesn't want to get locked up. He'd rather kill himself than face the consequences of his terrible actions. Like, that's so gross. It's so disgusting.
Literally, like, that's crazy. I don't know. Like, he's, what a weirdo, bro. Like, these poor girls can never do anything with their life because this man is, like, so...
Because this man.
This man.
And now he's, like, and now he's out here, like, whining about it. Like, you did this.
The fact that he's actually whining, like, it's not like, oh, yeah, he's whining, yeah, like, talking normally. No, he's actually whining to the police.
He's, like,
he's actually calling the police.
I can't believe this.
The fact that he's actually whining is immensely, like, weird. Like,
I mean, Yanni, you work with children. Like, how often
they don't
do
even
hear?
Whine like that. Like, you can still tell, like, it's forced because nobody talks like that. Not even children.
Yeah. By this point, the police decided that their best bet is releasing the phone call to the public. They hoped that someone would be able to recognize and identify the voice belonging to the man making the calls. You'd think that only a handful of people would call in claiming that they recognize the voice, especially since it's, like, a very distinct voice. But that wasn't the case at all. Hundreds of people called in thinking that the caller was someone they knew. Investigators looked into every single one of the names given to them, but they all led them nowhere. 2 months had passed, and the police still had no leads on either case. There weren't any substantial pieces of evidence or information that fueled their investigation, and detectives on this case were desperate for something, anything, that would help them spin the wheels. Around this time, the Minneapolis police were called to a hostage situation in the area. A man named Alan Lopez had been keeping his entire family hostage in their home and brutally killed them. The police stationed themselves outside of the home for hours, trying to contain the scene and have him come out. They were trying to talk him and get him to peacefully surrender when Alan, out of nowhere, shouted out to the police that he was the one who killed Kimberly Compton. The police were like, oh, hold up, what now? And arrested him. He was found guilty for the murder of his family and he was sent to a mental facility. So at this point, the detectives are probably hyped, you know, like, it's been months and they finally have a suspect. They were probably thinking, you know, this guy, Alan, he was a violent man. I mean, he killed his entire family. He's definitely capable of doing the same to Kimberly, right? Now, all they had to do was go and question him, see if his story connected with any of the evidence that the investigators had, so that they would have a strong enough picture to close a case. The police waited a few days to question him, you know. They probably wanted him to be collected and settled down before they hounded him for the probable murder of another one of his victims. but they were too late. Days after he was sent to the facility, Alan Lopez committed suicide. Even though he was dead, investigators still had to look into Alan. Now they had to go back to the information they had at hand and essentially milk it for anything that would connect the cases to Alan. One thing they knew for sure was that whoever killed Kimberly had also attempted to kill Karen months prior. There was no doubt that these two cases were linked by those eerie phone calls. So they started off with their first case, Karen Potak's attack. When they investigated Alan's whereabouts during the night of her attack, they realized that he had been a patient at a mental facility. So, you know, it couldn't possibly be him, right? Well, they looked into it a little deeper, and it turns out Alan had been given a game pass, a freebie, to roam around the city on the same day that Karen was attacked. So now Alan is looking incredibly suspicious. So now they had to connect him to Kimberly Compton's murder. And if they were able to do that successfully, they'd have a solid case against him. So investigators look into where Alan was the day of Kimberly's murder. Turns out, he was in jail during that time, so it would have been impossible for him to have killed her. And if he didn't kill Kimberly, it's more likely that he had nothing to do with the case connected to Karen's attack. The police were back where they started from. No leads and no new information. The trail went cold and they were back to square one. On August 5th, 1982, 911 operators received a fourth mysterious phone call.
Fire emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one over safe. Oh, I don't know what you're mad at me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both of them. I'm sorry. I'll never make it to heaven.
Calm down. Calm
down. Terrible. I don't think there's much to say about it.
And now that he's talking about that he'll never make it to heaven, excuse me, you're killing, like, so many people. Like, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, like, how would you expect to make it, like, if you believe in heaven, how would you expect to make it there? You,
exactly.
Like, attacked a girl and killed, like, two people.
Yeah.
Or, like,
especially if you
whatever.
Believe in, like, heaven and hell and stuff like that. Like, how are you gonna do that? How? How?
You think God is gonna give you a freebie, dude?
Like, oh, okay. As you should know.
Okay, buddy. Oh, I'm sorry. You cried. No, dude. Can you imagine being the 911 operator? You're, like, just trying to, like, do your job. Like, you have your headset on. You're drinking your coffee. And
this man said, no, never, like, make it a heaven. Like, no, boy, like, what you going through?
She's like, the 911 operator's probably like, I'm literally here trying to do my job. I'm not your, like, pastor. Like, take that on with your church, dude. What the hell? I love how she's like, does she say calm down at the end?
Yeah. She was like, sir,
girl,
calm
I
down.
Love her. She's my hero.
For real,
the
she's
operator
like, what?
Is my hero. He's literally, like, saying he killed people, and she's like, huh? Calm down, first of all.
Sir, calm. Calm it down.
Sir, this is not the time or place. Why are you... I want to be her. Someone leak her name so I can follow her.
Calm down and take it outside. Not here. Take it outside.
She said do some meditation or something. Yeah.
So the following day, 40-year-old nurse Barbara Simon's dead body had been found by the Mississippi River. She had been stabbed over 100 times. The police managed to trace her movements the night before her murder. They found out that she had actually been hanging out alone at a local bar called the Hexagon Bar. The police went to the bar and interviewed all the baristas and waitresses that worked there. According to them, Barbara had been all alone all night, up until a man approached her and offered her a cigarette. According to the witnesses at the bar, this man was around 40 years old, 6 feet tall, 185 pounds, white, with a receding hairline.
Okay, sir. You better go get that wig.
So every white man ever.
Every white man ever.
I'm not surprised. This is the description for every, like, white serial killer ever.
Serial killer, yes. Every white, like, oh. He sounds like John Wayne Gacy.
Also, like, true. Like, why is a receding hairline there? Like, wow. Do you think all serial killers have a receding hairline?
Yes.
It's probably like the
some
stress
of them, it's like half and half. Some of them are like just like receding hairline, and somebody just has a full head of hair. Like
true, like Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy had a full head.
A full head of hair. Yes.
He had a full entire skull.
It was gushing out. Full head. Nothing fit in there.
He had a skull, bro.
He had a big, fat skull.
He had a big brain on him, dude.
Yo.
But no, this guy, a complete opposite. Receding hairline. They did him dirty. He deserves
he did himself
it.
Dirty.
He deserves it, though. They said, oh, he killed people? Receding hairline.
As you should.
If it was a guy they were trying to find his description because he was missing but he hadn't killed anyone, I wouldn't have mentioned the receding hairline. I feel like that's a little mean, you know, you want to kill people
all right, yeah. Then we're gonna throw it out there to the world that you got a receding that's hairline, like, oh
yeah,
you trying to hide him in a wig,
no. Not the bangs, no.
Yeah, God said no heaven and no hair. Oh,
no heaven and and no that's so sad.
Didn't deserve it.
Oh my god, I forgot what I was gonna say. I literally forgot what I was gonna say.
He was actually tall. Like, 6 feet? 40-year-old, yeah, like, 6 feet and no hair.
They should have made him 5'2", like.
Yeah, short.
No, let's not disrespect the short kings like that.
Okay.
You're like, alright.
Okay.
Nah, I would have been like, oh, so like he was 185 pounds.
Well, then
white,
he was fairly skinny.
Hairline.
Was he fairly skinny? I have never seen the picture. But.
Yeah, for 6 feet and 185, that's pretty skinny.
That's fairly skinny. But like, he's only 185 and he's 6 feet tall. So,
he was like pretty slim. But here's the thing, though. Like okay, on our Instagram, if you go to iMurder Podcast, you'll find a picture of him. I don't think he really looks like too slimmy thick. You know, he looks like
slimmy thick.
He looks like an average man. He looks like an average man to me.
Did he just say slimmy thick?
I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Yeah. He didn't look like he had, you know, like a VS model type beat, but no.
Slimmy thick with a receding hairline. Oh.
When the murderer is a slimmy thick God. With a receding hairline.
Yeah, go off, sir. Go off. Don't kill
honestly,
people, but go
wait.
Off.
Go off. Before we move on, can I talk about my biggest fear? Like, my biggest fear is going missing, but not just going missing, but, like someone describing me, like,
a
yeah,
big
she
nose,
has a big
white.
Nose and, like, huge pores. Huge, insanely huge pores. Yeah. And, like, they're like, yeah, she's 5'4", brown hair, fair skin, and she has a giant zit on her forehead.
Yeah, always does. Always does.
I think I would rather them never find me after that. Anyway, moving on.
Moving on.
So, the two got along pretty well, and soon enough, they were seen dancing and chatting together. The man had actually offered to give her a ride home, and Barbara wasn't going to pass the opportunity up. So she went up to the bar towards the end of the night to order one more drink before she left, and said to the waitress, quote, "I hope this man is nice. He's giving me a ride home," end quote. I definitely think that Barbara experienced a gut feeling in that moment. Like, beneath all of the funk conversation and perhaps even charisma that this guy had, something was off with him. And just from that one comment, the waitress made a conscious effort to take a good look at the man before they left. The police brought the waitress into the station to look over a collection of mugshots belonging to numerous possible suspects on the case. She began looking through every single one, trying to connect the features before her to the features she saw in person earlier that week. They were reaching the end of the pile when finally, a spark of familiarity hit her. She pointed at the mugshot before her, confident that this was the man who had taken Barbara home that unfaithful night. That man in the mugshot was 38-year-old Paul Michael Stefani, who was charged for aggravated assault. He had a history of mental illness, which perhaps wouldn't seem relevant since almost everyone has a history of mental illness nowadays, even in the slightest. But if we listen back to those 911 calls, you could see how the person behind them, like I said earlier, could be profiled as someone with a debilitating mental illness. Like, he seemed to be split in two. One side of him was an uncontrollable, violent monster. The other side of him was a remorseful, desperate man. It's giving James McAvoy from Split, if I'm honest.
Oh my god, this man's literally crazy.
Am I wrong? No, he's definitely like going, like, definitely has mental issues. Like, you can't be mentally stable and healthy and be able to do what he's done.
You could tell, like, his voice is just not right. Like,
it's not
the
right.
Calls, especially like just like murdering somebody and then calling the cops. That's just like, that's like the first red flag. Like, most people don't.
First red flag,
like,
yeah.
Most serial killers don't.
He's definitely not organized.
Yeah.
You can tell he's not an organized killer.
He's definitely not. Like, there's something else going on in his head. Like,
yeah. So the investigators also found that before Karen Potak's attack, Stefani worked at a manufacturing shop, the same place where Karen's injured body was found. Perhaps after working there for as long as he had, Stefani knew that there would be no one around to witness him attempting to kill Karen that night. This was enough to convince the police that they would need to keep a careful eye on this man. So they put Stefani on 24/7 undercover police surveillance. They were watching his every move, hoping to find evidence that could be used against him. The day after Stefani was put under surveillance on August 21st, 1982, he got in his car and just drove off. He drove and drove until the police ultimately lost him. To me, it seems like Stefani might have known that he was being watched and wanted to get away from the police. He drove to Minneapolis, Red Light District, and picked up 19-year-old Denise Williams, who was a sex worker in the area. They negotiated prices. Denise charged $100, but Stefani only had $40 on him. They made a deal that he would give her what he had then, and after they had sex, they would go back to his house and he would give her the rest of the money. They went through with the deal. He even went back to his house and paid her... Hold on. They went through with the deal. He even went back to his house and paid her his due. It was late after they were done, so Stefani offered Denise to take her back to the Red Light District where he picked her up from. So they both got in his car and made their way to the Red Light District. After a while, Denise started noticing that Stefani had been taking a strange route. He took several turns that led to pitch black roads, and Denise started to get worried. She had that gut feeling that something was wrong. So she asked him where he was going, and he told her not to worry. He was taking the back roads because there was a shortcut that he was familiar with. But Denise knew that that was, you know, like, bullshit. She had been a sex worker for 6 years, ever since she was 13 years old. Meaning she knew those streets like the back of her hand. She knew all the shortcuts, every nook and cranny in the area. And where they were driving, it definitely wasn't familiar to her. At this point, Denise is panicking. She starts to desperately but discreetly look around the car for anything that would help her escape. That was when she spotted an empty glass bottle rolling around on the floor of the car. Denise knew that this would have been enough to help her defend herself in the case that this man tried anything on her. Soon enough, Stefani pulled over into a dead-end street and stopped the car. What's interesting is that the area wasn't empty. It was actually full of houses lined around the street, so there were people around. The only thing is that it was late, so most people were asleep, you know. Clearly, he hadn't really thought the location out. He reached over to the left side of the car, grabbed a screwdriver he had lying around, and stabbed Denise in the stomach with it. So Denise did what she had planned. She grabbed the glass bottle as fast as she could and smashed it against Stefani's face. The broken glass cut him deeply in his cheek, causing him to bleed profusely. Blood was everywhere at this point, even inside of Denise's eyes, which of course blinded her momentarily. They fell into a struggle between Denise trying to escape the car and Stefani trying to keep a hold of her. Somehow, Denise was able to open the car and slide onto the ground outside. Stefani was quick and rolled over on top of her, stabbing her in the process. Now remember, the area where they were having the struggle in wasn't empty. There were houses around them with sleeping people in them. After hearing Denise's screams and the commotion outside, a man named Doug Panning had his windows open and decided to investigate what was going on. When he saw the scene before him, the loud and violent stabbing, Denise's desperation to be free, Doug ran over to intervene. He grabbed Stefani by the shoulders to shove him off of her, but Stefani was in killer mode. Stefani lifted the screwdriver to stab Doug, but he went sprinting back inside his house before he could, and he called 911. Stefani realized that the police were probably going to be there soon, so he got in his car and ran off, leaving Denise behind. An ambulance was called for her, and she was sent off to the hospital. The girl was truly a warrior. She had suffered from a punctured liver and a punctured lung on top of numerous other injuries. She was rushed into an emergency surgery and survived. The same night, the police received yet another 911 phone call. As if we had enough.
I need an ambulance.
Where?
1505 Westminster.
1505?
Yes.
Westminster, what's the problem?
I'm all cut up. I got beat up.
What's your apartment number?
208. I'm bleeding.
208. Where are you bleeding from?
From my arm, my face, my head.
Not him calling an ambulance for himself.
Yep.
Oh.
How funny is that?
But also, like, I bet this one he gets freaking caught. Hopefully. Hopefully. He literally sounds the same.
Hopefully. We'll see. Like, at this point, they're, like, looking out for the calls because, like, they've had so many. Yeah. That they're like, okay, there's no way that, like, we're not going to get another.
And the fact that they already knew who he was, though, so.
Yeah, because he was a suspect, yeah. Right? So, that's interesting. We're going to see how that plays out now.
All right, let's do this.
All right. So Stefani was sent to the hospital to be treated for his injuries. While that happened, the police started putting the pieces of the puzzle together. This man, who was suspected of murder and under police surveillance, was lost. And within the hour that he was lost, a woman had almost been killed. Denise told the investigators every detail that she remembered, including having fought her attacker with a glass bottle and cutting his face with it. So when the police saw that he had the same injuries she had described, they knew they had their guy. Denise was shown hundreds of mugshots to identify her attacker, and lo and behold, she recognized and chose Paul Stefani. However, the police couldn't detain him just yet. They needed to collect more evidence to pin the other connected cases against him. The police brought Stefani in for questioning to see if they could get anything out of him. He was a bit compliant at first, you know, answering questions carefully and all that, but then the detective placed a case file on the table, one entitled The Weepy-Voiced Killer. In that moment, Paul Stefani's entire demeanor changed. He knew this questioning was a lot bigger than he thought. He knew that they were suspecting him for the crimes he had committed. From this point on, he became agitated and snarky with his responses. He even stood up from his seat at one point and said, quote, "You're not going to pin those on me," end quote. And in this moment, the interviewer realized something. The way Stefani's voice pitch grew higher when he was upset sounded very familiar, much like the voice in the phone calls. The police charged him with the murder of Barbara Simons. They were also pretty confident that he had been the perpetrator in the other two connecting cases, but they couldn't do anything about it since it was outside of their city limits jurisdiction, given that they were in Minneapolis and the other cases were in St. Paul. So the investigators started focusing on the evidence they had, which connected Stefani to the Barbara Simons case. They started with their defining piece of evidence, the weepy phone calls. The man from the phone calls would report some damning proof that he was the murderer, such as what the victims were wearing or where they would find them, even how he killed them. There was no doubt that the caller was a killer, especially because all the details he would mention would go completely unreported to the media, so no one on the outside would know except the killer and the police. The police brought some vocal experts to come into the station and listen to these phone calls and compare them with the recording of Stefani's police interview. The experts reported that although these two voices were extremely similar, they couldn't say for sure that they were the same person. Stefani's trial for the murder of Barbara Simons finally began in that same year. During his trial, his sister, ex-wife, and roommate testified against him, stating that the voice in the phone calls was his. His sister even removed her headphones while listening to the tape and completely broke down in tears, stating that it was indeed her brother. Paul Michael Stefani pled not guilty for the murder of Barbara Simons and the attack of Denise Williams, even though there was literally a mountain of evidence against him. Ultimately, the evidence was enough to charge Stefani as guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and he was sent to 58 years in prison for both of the attacks. As for the other two murders, it was up to St. Paul police to charge him and send him to prison. But they didn't. They knew he was guilty, but they didn't find it necessary to send him on trial. Apparently, They thought that because he was going to be incarcerated for so long, he wouldn't need to waste time in a courtroom piling on the years that he would be locked up, which honestly pisses me off. It shouldn't be up to these officers to decide whether it's convenient to send someone on trial for numerous murders. I mean, like, think about the other victims. Think about Karen and Kimberly, their family. They won't ever get to experience full justice for their attacks because the police don't find it important. It's so dumb. It's ridiculous.
That's literally crazy also because only 58 years and he's what, 30? Yeah. 30 something?
Yeah.
When he gets if he doesn't die in jail, he's still going to be like 80 something when he gets out.
Exactly. You'd expect it to be life, you know, because not only did he attempt to kill someone, he also murdered someone.
Exactly.
Which should be like automatic life, you know?
Automatic. What a monster.
What a monster. But
those
dude.
Police officers are monsters too. I hate when the police don't do anything.
When they don't do their job.
When they don't do their job. It's like, why are you
working? What's crazy is that he pled not guilty.
Honestly,
usually you get a lesser sentence when you plead guilty.
Yeah,
usually they give you a deal and you get less years. Mm-hmm. But he pled like against
which he should get
against
more.
The court.
Which he should get more. So he should get more for that. It. So, like, imagine if he would have pled guilty.
That's what I'm saying. Imagine if he would have said that he was guilty, he would have gotten, like, what, 30 years?
Oh,
that's crazy.
That's horrible.
This was also in the 80s, but not saying the justice system has improved, because it probably hasn't, but, like, this is just very telling. Yeah, but this is very telling. I guess, like, what is understandable is that they didn't have enough evidence against him, like, the St. Paul police.
Yeah.
So they would have to, like, put in more money and resources to find enough things to pin against him.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, because he was in jail, they could have used those resources on criminals that were still on the streets to incarcerate them. But it's still, like, it's a tricky subject. It still disappoints me because, like, I just think about the victims and, like, their families. Like, they deserve justice, you know?
They do.
In 1997, 12 years into Stefani's prison sentence, he was diagnosed with skin cancer and was told he had 2 years left to live. The first thing he did was request an interview with the St. Paul police. They met up with Stefani in prison, and he immediately confessed to all of his crimes, including the murder of Kimberly and the attack on Karen. He told police everything they knew about the attacks, but he included some context so that the stories would align accurately. And now I'm gonna play an interview clip and I'll describe what's going on after.
This way, or did you poke her with it?
No, I don't think I poked her. I remember just hitting her mainly on the forehead, on the cheek, and the jaw, the mouth, and the top of the head.
What you just heard was Stefani going over the details of his attack against Karen. His voice even started going a little bit higher at some point in the interview, like in the phone calls when he expressed his remorse, and we're gonna play that now.
I was even hurt when I went back to the car. Oh, there's going like this. I mean, and that's what made me want to go to the phone. I mean, I really wanted to help her. My mind started clearing up. What are you doing? You had a chance to make another friend. I kept yelling at myself. You like to make friends.
Especially
like,
his voice.
Did you hear his voice?
Yeah.
His voice sounds so, like, it. You can tell it's him from the phone calls. The way that he was saying it, he was like, what are you doing? Like, the way he sounds like Mickey Mouse, dude. Like,
he literally could be a voice actor, bro. That man has so many voices. It's like...
No, so true. Like, he really could. He could be, like, on, like, one of those horror animated movies. So, like, at this point, just even looking at that interview, you could tell that he is the person from the phone calls. So he then, like, later on in this interview, he confessed to the murder of Kimberly Compton, the girl he met at the diner years before. So she's the reason why he's in jail, but remember, he had he had pled not guilty. This time he admitted to it. And at this point, not only did he confess to all of the four attacks that we discussed in this episode, he confessed to a fifth one that police weren't even aware about. Well, we're gonna go over this. So according to Stefani, this was his second kill, one between Kimberly Compton and Barbara Simons. The victim was 33-year-old Catherine Greening. On July 21st, 1982, Catherine and her friend Carol were planning on going on a trip together. Carol went to Catherine's house that day to pick her up and knocked on her door, but no one answered. This was strange because she knew Catherine would be in the house ready for the trip. At this point, she noticed that the door was unlocked and walked inside. You know, maybe Catherine had been asleep or in the back room where she couldn't hear the door. When she walked in, it was completely silent. She looked through the entire house in almost every room, calling out for Catherine's name, but there was no sign of her. That was until she reached the bathroom. The door was half open and the light was still on. She slowly opened the door and there Catherine was, lying face down in the bathtub, dead. At first, investigators believed that the attack had some foul play involved. They looked into suspicious people in her life who might have had some motive in killing her, including her husband, but ultimately they couldn't find anything substantial and ruled her death an accident. Literally no one suspected the weepy voice killer to be involved in this case at all. I mean, for one, there was no phone call, and the MO was completely different. Catherine had been drowned to death while all of his other victims were violently stabbed or hit in the head. It was out of character. The investigators did, however, keep all the evidence they had from Catherine's case. They found a phone book that she had at the time, and written in the notebook was the name Paul S., which would obviously be Paul Stefani. Paul Michael Stefani died from terminal skin cancer in the Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison Infirmary on June 12, 1998. He was 53 years old. And that's the end of the case. So I want to hear your thoughts. What is your impression of this case? Do you think Stefani should have gone on trial for the other cases? Would there have even been a point? Like, honestly, what do you think overall?
Even if there wasn't a point of going, like, the other cases going into court and stuff like that, because he did die before his sentence was over, they should have done it because the justice, of course, the justice was just so wrong. And he should have 100% still gone through trial, but at least he didn't get out of jail, you know?
Exactly.
But,
like, morally, I definitely think that, like, he should have gone on trial just for the sake of the victims. It's not even about him. It's about those girls, dude.
Exactly. Like, the justice for them, their families, yeah, their everyone.
Their families.
Especially sure. This poor girl that they didn't even know was involved with him.
That's the worst part, right?
And they blamed it almost on her husband, which they always do.
They always do that. All right, listen, but it's almost always the husband.
It's almost always the husband.
But this time it wasn't. They
almost blamed it on him. See, it's like the justice system is like so weird. It's crazy. But it's glad that man didn't get out of jail beforehand.
Yeah, glad. I'm glad he faced the consequences of his own actions. Dude, karma.
No.
And he died. I'm surprised he wasn't killed in prison. Usually, like, people like this who kill young girls, like, for example, who was it? Was it Denise? Denise was 19. Kimberly was like 18. Like, they're all super young.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, I think this case is pretty crazy. This is a pretty heavily packed episode. There were a lot of details that, you know, I have to research. But I think, this is a case that has stuck with me for so long, specifically because of those phone calls.
The first time I heard those phone
calls, I had, like, chills up my spine. Like, it was so creepy. It's one of those things you can't listen to late at night because then you can't sleep.
Oh, my God, 100%. 100%. I think, poop my pants if I heard that at night.
No, like
imagine
actually,
sleeping
like,
and it just starts playing. Oh, heck no, I'll be running out of that door.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Like, hearing voice, no.
Oh,
so, that wraps up the episode. For all our listeners, you guys can leave your theories in our recent post on Instagram on this episode. Our Instagram is at imurderpodcast. If you also want to see photos related to this case, you can make sure to follow and check out our social media.
If you guys want to listen to our past episodes, make sure to find us on all our major podcast streaming sites like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We come out with a new episode every Monday.
And next week we're gonna be going into the supernatural, the paranormal. Ooh, it's gonna be a spooky best. Episode spooky, Yaneska's spooky. Gonna have Yaneska's gonna have her spooky stories, I'm gonna have my spooky stories, and we're just gonna like pee our pants together
and we're gonna talk about it. Oh, we love spooky.
And we're gonna talk about it. And as always, you can't be a hottie
if you're a dead body.
Bye.